You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up on our homepage. I'm Dan Gould. Saunders Midyet, Vice President and National Sales Director for the St. Clair Group, Incorporated, presented an overview of the Patient Protection and Affordability Act. Jim Hayden, President and Chief Executive Officer at Martha Jefferson Health Services and Hospital, and Carol Craig, Government Relations Specialist at the University of Virginia Medical Center, addressed how the cost and access for Virginians will be affected by the act. The panelists spoke at the September 8, 2010 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Charlottesville Senior Center. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV board member and secretary, Bill Davis.
Well, we're very fortunate to have an outstanding program with a terrific panel. All these folks are extremely well qualified to talk about this issue, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time going into the bio on each of them. Simply because we want to have as much time for questions afterwards. Each speaker will speak for about 15 minutes, and after that, after the last one finishes, we'll take questions. And we do podcast our meeting, so when you have a question, just hold your hand up, and one of our board members will bring you the microphone for you to use. And we ask you please speak into the microphone so we can get it on our recording. Saunders Midyet is Vice President and National Sales Director for the St. Clair Group, and he's going to present an overview of the Patient Protection and Affordability Act, which is the health care program recently enacted. Jim Hayden is the President and CEO of Martha Jefferson Health Systems and Martha Jefferson Hospital, and I'm proud to say that Jim is a member of SSV, so we're delighted to have him on our roster.
I think I owe you this year's dues.
Well,
so don't let me out without paying.
Well, we'll forgive you this time, Jim.
No, I'm happy to do that.
Carol Craig is Government Relations Specialist with the University of Virginia Medical Center. And we're very happy and pleased to have all three of these speak to us. So I'll ask Saunders to take the first presentation.
Good afternoon. As Bill indicated, my presentation focus is on the Patient Protection and Affordability Act, which became law with the signing by President Obama on March 30th, 2010. The four key objectives of the Health Act reforms are, first, to increase access to health insurance by providing coverage to millions of uninsured individuals through Medicaid. The second is to change insurance rules to protect individuals from arbitrary health coverage limits and exclusions by insurers like Anthem and Optima in Virginia. The third is to build on existing employer and government-sponsored insurance programs. Anthem and Optima are used by many Virginia employers to provide health coverage for their employees. In terms of government-sponsored health programs, Medicaid is one. Original Medicare is another, and Medicare Advantage plans. The fourth objective of the Act is to accomplish these health reforms with a phased implementation schedule beginning in 2010 and ending 10 years later in 2020. Let's now look at the insurer mandates under the Health Act reforms. These mandates apply to all employer health, group health insurance plans, and to all individual health insurance plans. In 2010, the first four insurer mandates are: 1, no lifetime benefit limits on coverage; 2, no denial of coverage on children with pre-existing conditions; and 3, no cancellation of coverage for individuals if they get sick; and 4, dependent children up to age 26 can stay on their parents' coverage. Also, beginning in 2010, insurers must pay a rebate to policyholders if their medical expenses exceed, and it should be 15% or 20% of their respective group and individual insurance premiums. Also, beginning in 2010 and through 2014, the Act will use temporarily state and federal health high-risk insurance pools. These pools will be used to cover early retirees, ages 55 or older, who are not yet eligible for Medicare. They will also be used for individuals with pre-existing health conditions. Beginning in 2014, all insurer group and individual health plans are required to provide the Act-defined essential health benefits. The Act essential benefits include the four following additions in 2014. First, no insurance coverage denials for pre-existing conditions. Second, no annual limits on coverage. Third, no denial of coverage based upon health status, like having high blood pressure. And fourth, coverage of preventive care services, like flu shots. Also, in 2014, an information exchange of available health insurance plans will be created by zip code within each state. The objective of this exchange is to simplify for employers and individuals comparison of available health plans, insurance plans. The plans, each of those plans will be rated as to the percentage of essential health benefit cost covered. So, for example, if a plan covers 90% of the health cost, it would be placed in a platinum group, and there's a gold group, silver group, as well at lower percentage levels. These percentages of health benefit cost mean that while the insurers will offer all essential health benefits in their plans beginning 2014, they will have the option of varying deductibles and co-pays, which are paid by the policyholder. Let's now look at the Medicare mandates under the Health Act reforms. In 2010, Medicare beneficiaries receive a $250 rebate when they reach the pharmacy donut hole coverage gap. In 2011, beneficiaries will receive new benefits. First, a 50% discount on covered brand name drugs within the donut hole gap. Second, they will have preventive care services covered, and they will get a free annual physical. Also in 2011, federal payments will be significantly reduced to Medicare Advantage plans. Currently, Medicare Advantage plans cost the government $1,000 per individual more than the cost of original Medicare. And so these reductions are, in effect, to reduce that differential so that they will not be spending so much more than they would for original benefits. Beginning in 2012, beneficiaries will receive annually additional drug savings until the donut hole gap is completely eliminated in 2020. So let's now take a look at the Medicaid impacts under the Health Act reforms. Beginning in 2010, many currently uninsured individuals will become Medicaid eligible for health plan coverage. This will be accomplished by raising the income level at which an individual or family qualifies for Medicaid coverage. So, through this qualification process, an additional 1 million individuals will become Medicaid eligible in 2010. An additional 11 million will become eligible by 2017, in the intervening years. And an additional 20 million will become eligible by 2019. So in total, an estimated additional 32 million individuals will become Medicaid eligible during 2014, 15, and 16. The resulting increase in the Medicare program costs for these currently uninsured individuals will be 100% federally funded. Let's now look at the individual mandates under the Health Act reforms. In 2013, families with an annual income above $250,000 are required to pay an additional 3.8% tax on investment income and also to contribute more to the Medicare program and payroll taxes. In 2014, all U.S. citizens and legal residents are required to have health care coverage or face an annual federal penalty. In 2014, the penalty for an individual is $95, for a family is $285, or 1% of taxable household income, whichever is greater. In 2014, unemployed individuals will receive tax credits for health insurance purchases. The amount of the credit varies with where their income falls, as noted here, 133% to 400% of the federal poverty income level. The federal poverty income level currently is approximately $11,000 for an individual. So you're multiplying the 133% to 400% times that individual base. For a family of four, it's approximately $22,000. And so again, you'd be multiplying that percentage. In 2014, employed individuals will not receive tax credits for health insurance purchases, with one exception. If the employer's health plan pays less than 60% of the health benefit cost, then those employees would be eligible, and it would depend on their income level as to the amount of tax credit. In 2016, there is an increase in the annual penalty for individuals with no health plan coverages. In that year, the penalty for an individual will be $695, or 2.5% of the taxable household income, whichever is greater. Now let's look at the employer mandates under the Health Act reforms. In 2010, small businesses of less than 50 employees can receive tax credits to purchase health plan coverage for their employees. In 2014, businesses of 50 or more employees must offer the essential health benefits plan or pay an annual penalty. That annual penalty is $2,000 per employee. In 2014, small businesses that's less than 50 employees are exempted from the requirement of offering an essential health plan benefit to their employees. In closing, I thank you for this opportunity to make this presentation, and we'll look forward to your questions after we've all presented.
Now we will have Carol Craig and Jim Hayden address how cost and access for Virginians will be affected by the act. And perhaps Carol could go first.
Okay, well, I thank y'all for having me here today, and I hope I can provide you with some interesting information. Some of it has already been covered by Saunders, but I guess it doesn't hurt to hear it twice. Maybe it'll sink in a little better. I want to focus on particularly on the impact on seniors, and Saunders went over this in his presentation, but if you go to the government's website, which is listed at the bottom, www.healthcare.gov, and if you haven't been there, I really commend to you to go, because there's a lot of helpful information there, and they break it down by classes of individuals. So they have seniors. You click on the seniors button, and it gives you information specifically for you. So the top five things that the government wants you to know about Medicare, your Medicare benefits, are that your existing benefits won't be reduced or taken away, and your ability to choose your doctor will not be taken away either. If you are in the Medicare prescription drug plan and you are in the donut hole, which is where you are paying for all your drugs, this year you'll get a tax rebate of $250, which I think a lot of people have already received, and if not, they should be coming soon. Then starting in 2011, if you're in the donut hole again, you'll get a 50% discount on brand name drugs while you're in the donut hole. And then between 2010 and 2020, they'll close the gap, and you'll get continuous Medicare coverage for your prescription drugs. Again, starting in 2011, Medicare will cover certain preventive services without you paying a copay or deductible, and you'll get a free wellness exam as well. And most importantly, the life of the Medicare Trust Fund has been extended an additional 12 years, they estimate, till about 2029 as a result of the reforms that were made through the law. Now, what they don't mention in the top five things is that if you are a Medicare Advantage beneficiary, as Saunders pointed out, you are likely to see some reduction in your benefits with that. Now, so that's what the government says. And the National Center for Policy Analysis, which is a conservative think tank organization, says this about health care reform. Medicare recipients will replace Medicaid recipients at the bottom of the health care ladder as early as 2019, when fees paid to providers are scheduled to be cut below Medicaid rates, and that the cuts to Medicare over the next decade will force 1 in 7 healthcare facilities out of business. And by 2050, 40% of facilities will be forced to close. And also the wait for care will be much longer because there will be more people accessing the system and there won't be enough providers to take care of them. So you can see that the government likes to emphasize the coverage aspects of the bill, which are good, and the critics of healthcare reform like to point out the cost and access issues. So it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out. You know, I have to admit, it's hard for me to get my arms around the whole thing and really understand how it all is going to work together, and I'm sure that there are going to be some surprises along the way, maybe some unintended consequences. So turning to some access issues, beginning in 2014, there won't be 32 million newly insured Americans right away, but starting then, they estimate that there will be about 32 million people covered that aren't now. And of those, about 16 million will be covered through the exchanges that are going to be operated through the states beginning in 2014. So, you know, if your employer doesn't provide coverage, you can go to the exchange and buy some insurance. 16 million will likely enroll in Medicaid, but there will still be about 23 million people that will remain uninsured. And it's estimated that about a third of those will be due to undocumented immigrants. And I think the rest will be, you know, people that just choose to pay the penalty because it's less than their premiums, or they just, you know, have a philosophical problem with being forced to pay for insurance. Now, here in Virginia, the Virginia Hospital and Healthcare Association estimates that about 36% of currently uninsured Virginians will get coverage through the exchanges operated by the states beginning in 2014. And about 30% will get coverage through Medicaid. I don't quote me on this, but I think that may raise the numbers as much as by 400,000 or something. It's also likely that about 33% of currently uncompensated care will remain that way, and a lot of that will be due to unpaid copays and deductibles, but about 10% of that may be due to undocumented immigrants. So with 32 million newly insured people, it says in 2014, that's not exactly true, but there will be a lot more people being insured. How will the healthcare system accommodate them? Here in Virginia, our Secretary of Health and Human Resources, Dr. Bill Hazel, has established a statewide initiative to start planning for this, and he's got some subcommittees meeting right now, and so hopefully in the next few months we'll be seeing some reports come out on how Virginia will handle you know, all the new Medicaid patients and so on and so forth. Now, the primary care physicians are going to be on the front line of taking care of many of these people. And so the health care reform bill tries to compensate them for this. So in 2013 and 2014, primary care doctors will be paid Medicare rates for Medicaid patients, which is a higher rate. And then physicians providing primary care services in mainly rural areas will receive 10% bonus payments between 2011 and 2015. So the law is trying to keep those physicians practicing where they are practicing. In part, that's because there is a workforce shortage looming. The baby boomers are aging, and physicians are growing older and getting ready to retire. So there will be a shortage. And That leads me to a discussion of graduate medical education. Whoops, wrong button, sorry. Don't know how to get out of that. I don't know. Okay, well, sorry. Graduate medical education. This is near and dear to our hearts at UVA because we train residents. And thank you. The graduate medical education program is funded in large part by Medicare. And the good news is that the funding was not cut by health care reform. However, prior to health care reform being enacted, the number of resident training slots was capped. And there was a bill that was introduced that asked for 15,000 new slots throughout the country, but that was rejected. So the training slots are capped. And what health care reform does do is it will redistribute any unused residency slots primarily to rural areas, more or less. And so if a hospital is not using all of its training slots or if a hospital closes, those slots will be redistributed throughout the country. However, UVA is not going to be eligible for any of those redistributed residency slots. So our numbers are going to remain stagnant as they are pretty much across the country. So while the slots will be capped, no more additional training slots, at the same time, healthcare reform makes more money available to help fund the medical education of medical students, and particularly with primary care and surgeons. So they are hoping to, help increase the numbers there. Yet at the same time, if there could be a situation created, but where there are more medical students being graduated than there are residency training slots available, and if that happens, there will definitely be a lot of angry physicians. In the meantime, we can use physician extenders such as nurse practitioners and physician assistants to help take care of the workforce shortage, and they will be key, I think, to implementing health care reform. Okay, so turning to some cost issues, the bill includes a number of payment reforms, and I'm only going to talk about two of them that have to do with Medicare. One is value-based purchasing for hospitals. And what this does is it decreases the base Medicare amounts that hospitals are paid. They'll be increasingly decreased from 2013 through 2017. Now, those reductions will help fund value-based incentive payments to hospitals based on quality and efficiency measures. And so what will happen is that the government will look at how the hospital does in treating the conditions that are listed there. And if the hospital has provided quality service, efficiently and with less cost, then the hospital will be eligible for an incentive payment. So the idea is to incentivize a hospital to, provide better care at less cost. Now, another payment reform that's being talked about a lot is going to happen through a model called accountable care organizations. And some people are a little afraid that they may be like HMOs, but hopefully they will not go the way of HMOs. The government is going to establish a Medicare shared savings program by January 1st, 2012. So let me back up and tell you what an accountable care organization is. It's a group of providers that get together to cover patients, provide the continuum of care for those patients. And in this program, they will agree to be accountable for the overall care of Medicare of their Medicare patients for at least 3 years, and care for at least 5,000 patients, and there are other requirements that they need to meet too. And the ACO will be eligible for shared savings, kind of an incentive payment, if it meets quality and performance standards and its costs are below a certain benchmark set by the government. So the idea, again, is that the ACO will provide integrated service, more integrated care, rather than the fragmented care that we tend to get now. It's moving away from the fee-for-service model that we have now that rewards quantity of services rather than quality of services. And again, if the ACO provides quality care to its patients among the spectrum of care of the patient, then it will be eligible for an incentive payment. And there are a number of other reform models that are in the law that the government can choose to pilot. The ACO is one of them, and for instance, that may not work very well in rural areas. It's kind of designed for more of a, it seems like it's designed for more of a populated area. So there are other things such as bundling or medical homes that that might work better in rural areas. And the government will look to see which works the best and then decide to implement those. And again, all the payment reforms are designed to encourage healthcare providers to provide more integrated care, better care, more efficiently and at lower cost, and hopefully that will mean good things for you all, better care at less cost, you get more value. So I'm sure you're aware that there have been legal challenges to the law, and Virginia is one of the states that has filed a lawsuit against the federal government. Our suit is based on House Bill 10 that was passed last year, which says that Virginia residents can't be required to obtain or maintain health insurance coverage, and they can't be charged a penalty for not doing so. So it creates a conflict between state and federal law, and which forms the basis for the lawsuit. The case has already survived one round of challenges, and it's thought that it may last about 2 to 3 years, and ultimately will probably go up to the Supreme Court to be decided. It is unlikely that the entire bill will be thrown out. I think that's what most people think. Maybe certain portions of it will be, but it's likely that healthcare reform is here to stay in some shape or form. And I think most health providers are in favor of that because they realize that the current system is not sustainable. So just very briefly, a little bit about what UVA is doing. I really don't know a whole lot to tell you, but we are working on patient progression. We're trying to improve our, we're trying to cut down on the average length of stay as an inpatient in the hospital to help with cost. We're trying to cut down on the amount of time that it takes to get an outpatient appointment to help with access issues. We're looking at possibly forming an ACO, but that's very preliminary right now. We of course will continue to advocate for increased funding for residency training slots to help with the workforce shortage issue, and we'll look for opportunities to provide additional outpatient access points in the area. So with that, I'll turn the program over to Mr. Hayden.
Need a clicker because I don't have a PowerPoint. I hope you don't mind. One, I want to thank Saunders and Carol for their presentations because it's actually very, very helpful to me. I want to thank you all. I want to thank Charlie and Bill for inviting me here today. I look forward to this conversation. I wish I were just out in that audience so I could be asking you two about a lot of this information. Let's see, there's one, I don't know, it's a conflict of interest. I need to declare, since it was mentioned that you used Optima as an example. I am on the board of Optima. Optima is a health insurance company here in the state of Virginia, and it's a not-for-profit, and it's run out of the Sentara healthcare system, so I just wanted to let you know that. I don't think there's anything else I necessarily need to declare. But I think as you've seen from both presentations, especially Saunders, that that health care bill, which is closer to 2,000 pages than it is to 1,000 pages, and the regulations have not been written, and as you can see, it's phased in over a good number of years. And so given that, sometimes with every page of a bill, there can be 30 pages of regulation. So there's a lot that certainly I don't understand, and I think the industry doesn't understand, and I'm sure just like Carolyn Saunders, I get emails from all sorts of consulting groups and companies, you know, trying to describe it. And, you know, what they do, they start off by saying this caveat of, we don't completely understand this bill because it's 2,000 pages and, you know, a lot of it hasn't been written and a lot of it's going to be challenged and so on and so forth. So a lot of us are trying to do the best we can in making plans for how we react to it both in the near term, the immediate term, the near term, and the long term. And so I thought I'd talk a little bit about that as well. I know that Charlie said that you were all interested in how it affects all of you. Well, I think it affects you in two ways. As senior citizens, I think that the Medicare program is going to be just fine. Until it goes broke, it's going to be just fine. But I don't think that's going to happen. And I think that, quite frankly, that there are adjustments that certainly need to be made. But the Medicare population, as you well know, are voters. And certainly the politicians are well aware of that. And just as Saunders' presentation, you know, pointed out, perhaps, and so did Carol's, the estimated cost and the savings, those still haven't, you know, necessarily come together. There's the idea that savings through preventative health, you know, early detection, and the like, will, you know, in the end, make up for all the additional expenses. That remains to be seen. I don't think anyone knows for a good number of years, and I don't mean two or three. I mean, you know, a much longer period of time. And as you saw, I think it was on your slides, Carol, it showed $575 billion of costs coming out of the healthcare system. And you could describe that as waste, as some people do. Some people describe it as fraud. But as someone once said to me, that is, what is one person's waste is another person's job. And so it's going to be very, very contentious over the years. And as Carol has ended up, the challenge to medical schools and to physicians is that, quite frankly, they have, the Medicare program has been talking about a 20% cut to physicians' payments, certain, you know, specialists and the like. 20% is a large amount to just adjust to, you know, very, very quickly. That keeps getting put off, but in the end, that probably, you know, some portion of that will happen, because that is part of how the $575 million of reduction occurs. A lot of that will probably move to hospitals because, as someone else reminded me, there's only 5,000 hospital CEOs in this country, but there's 700,000 physicians, so they can scream a lot louder than you hospital administrator types. So, but I think a lot of that is going to happen to physicians and hospitals. I think on the physician side, they're very challenged, especially the primary care physicians. Even if they should get a 10% increase, as you both know, it's very difficult for primary care physicians to practice in today's world. It's expensive. There's a lot of things that they have to do with their office staff, their malpractice insurance, and a lot of money they don't collect. And quite frankly, I think if you talk to most primary care physicians, while they might be very, very pleased that if they were taking Medicaid patients, now they're going to get Medicare payment in the future, that won't sustain their office practices on the primary care basis. And I know a lot of them that are beginning to say, I'm not going to take any new Medicare patients, or I can only take a set amount and keep my practice going. So I think the access part, while this health care plan is really opening up to many people who are not covered, and that's certainly good, the access part is going to be a real, real challenge. Again, Carol talked about the limited number of physician residency trainings that's going to be permitted. At a time in American history where a lot of physicians are going to be retiring. In fact, a lot of would have retired over the last couple of years, but their 401ks have diminished so much that they're working two or three, 4 years longer. Just like our nurses, the average age of a nursing, an inpatient and a hospital nurse is roughly 47 years of age, like our school teachers. So a lot of physicians,
as they get pushed and pushed with reduction in reimbursement, it's going to be more difficult for them to practice. Now, I'm not trying to sit here and say, gee, the poor physician, but it's a fact of life. It is out there, and they are challenged, especially, you know, primary care physicians who make, you know, far less than others. And whether they can get by in the future, you know, that remains to be seen. Again, I'm looking forward to the question period so I can ask Saunders some questions, because there's been articles in the Wall Street Journal, for instance, that talks about employer and sponsored health care plans that might be might be something that goes out of existence. And in fact, it was a Wall Street Journal article several months ago talking about, it was either Verizon or AT&T who pays approximately $2.3 billion for their over 200,000 employees each year for health care benefits. And they looked at the penalty, and the penalty amounted to $600 million. So they said, gee, we can pay $2.8 billion or we can pay $600 million. And then those employees would still be covered, but they would be moved into a government-sponsored health plan with the reimbursement, you know, going to doctors and hospitals as far, far less. And I was surprised to hear one businessman here in town said, well, I'm considering the same thing. I have 186 employees, and we have, a health plan, but a lot of people I compete with have no health plan at all. And so we're considering taking the penalty, which would be less. Whether that happens or not, I don't know. But when you have a health care plan as wide scope as this, it's going to have tremendous consequences, some of which will be unintended consequences, and we just don't know. I'm not here to talk against the health care plan. I'm just saying that is a fundamental change in the way health care is being delivered in America. And quite frankly, America needs some of that, because the path we're on is unsustainable in the long term. Having said that, I don't think anything compares to this, with the exception of maybe the Medicare program enactment in 1965 and 66. So this is a tremendous change that's going to affect a lot of individuals. And you also saw up here the insurance companies, what they're going to have to do. And I think probably the insurance companies are less loved than anyone else out there. But having said that, by giving them additional coverage items, which all in and of themselves may be very, very good and important and nice to have, to think that there isn't an additional expense to those is not being realistic. There just is. And I don't say that because I'm on the Optima board. The Optima board, as I mentioned, is a not-for-profit, and I got on just to have a voice from the hospital side, even though it's run by a hospital system as well. And I was on the QualChoice board, which the university had a health care plan many, many years ago. So, again, to have a voice at that sort of thing. Again, Carol mentioned some of these new things that might occur out of this: accountable care organizations, bundled payments, physician alignments, IT requirements. All of these things are pretty interesting, pretty good. Certainly it's good for the consultants out there, and that hospitals and doctors, insurance companies are going to have to figure out how to adjust to all of these. But these are very, very big adjustments. And I know that at Martha Jefferson Hospital, we've looked at some of the adjustments that we have to make from this year, 2010 through 2019. And we have one board member that says, you know, 2019 is the day after tomorrow, that we will have to reduce costs anywhere from $32 million to $40 million. Again, doesn't mean that we, you know, shouldn't be doing that and being looking at that, but it's this is big time change, and there's something, I guess, to both love in this health care bill and to be very, very concerned about at the same time. I was going to list some of those insurance mandates, but they were covered, you know, very well before me. But again, if you will, those are the preventive care requirements, the no limits, no denying of coverage, so on and so forth. My wife and I have a 21-year-old daughter. She's on our health plan, and now this will be extended till she's 26. You know, that's good for my wife and I, right? But for my employer, Martha Jefferson Hospital, that's an additional expense. It just is. So, you know, it's a balancing act. I'd mentioned reimbursement to physicians. The other thing I don't see enough in this health care plan is really some individual responsibility. You know, there really needs to be, I think, more of that as Americans. You know, we have become less healthy. We have don't exercise as much. We have become a population that is, has a large population, a portion of the population that's obese. And you can't drink too much, not exercise, smoke, be obese, and then come to a hospital or a physician's office when you're 55 or 60 and say, oh, gee, it shouldn't cost me anything. And I think this is something that mostly, your generation does, and I look around, didn't have this problem, but if you look around now and you go to a mall, you see that. So I think some of this has to come through, and I don't think the government can do that. I think we as a population and as a culture have to do that. But so much of our health care costs are related to lifestyle problems, behavioral problems, and, we need to address those as well. I'm looking at my notes. Everything was covered so well by my colleagues here. I might just stop. I look forward. I had a calendar. I don't know that it's needed now of the effects dates on the health care reform provisions. I'll leave this behind, and if anybody wants it, they can have a copy made of it. But again, this is a health care bill law that is enacted that some of things have started right away. Some go into play in 2014 and well beyond. And I know that one of the other considerations that you're beginning to see, for instance, this accountable care organizations and bundling, which is a form of capitation, is a lot of discussion at Martha Jefferson and I suspect at UVA, as you mentioned, but every other hospital in this country and medical group is how do we, change ourselves, and some of the change is really needed. But it's going to be difficult. I've always felt that people, in America say, hey, change is good, but they always mean it for someone else. And in this case, it's going to be for all of us. Hospitals are going to have to change. What you're beginning to see now is another round of hospitals talking to one another in terms of more integration amongst themselves, consolidation, affiliations, mergers, and the like. Not every hospital is going to be able to have certain elements or programs. Again, you'd say, gee, that's good. It can get the cost down. But again, what is one person's waste is another person's job. So there's offsets to that. And this is happening, rapidly. So I am going to stop. I don't know if that necessarily helps all of you in terms of how it necessarily affects you. I do think Saunders and Carol talked about that. There's probably more unknown about the health care bill than, quite frankly, known. A lot of it is still to be played out, and we'll all get to be involved in it, I'm sure.
And now we'll open it up for questions, and if you'll raise your hand and then direct your question to either an individual or if you want all three to answer, let us know.
Yes, my question relates to assisted living care, which either I or my wife may require sometime. We have no reason to believe we will, but we might. We both buy supplemental insurance. We both buy long-term care insurance, and from what we've been able to judge, neither one of those policies really takes care of the issue of some long-term care in an assisted living facility. Is there anything in any legislation that foresees some assistance in that particular era?
Who would like to take that?
Saunders might be the best. I don't.
I think assisted living, long-term care is mentioned, but it's not clear to me what coverage would be available under the Health Reform Act, and so I really can't answer your question.
There's something that's stated in the bill someplace that I read, but I don't think you should count on this bill providing the services you just talked about. I think everybody has to, look to themselves. Medicare does, again, Saunders would know better than I, provide certain coverage, if you go into a nursing home for a certain period of time, but there's a limit on that. And there's home care. There's a, you know, there's, you know, under the unintended consequences, if you go into a hospital as a Medicare patient and are deemed an observation patient and and not truly an inpatient, even though you're an inpatient, and the hospitals do this, the nursing do this, there's more work actually, and you get paid less, and then you are discharged. And believe me, the hospitals would like to designate you as an inpatient and not an observation patient because they get paid less. Then all of a sudden what you would be receiving in terms of benefits, home care visits, and the like is extremely limited, if there's any at all. So there are some takeaways as well. But I don't think it really addresses that issue that you talked about, to be honest.
There is a class program that's that is talked about in the bill. I don't know a whole lot about it. It's some kind of long-term care insurance, but it looked like it was really more kind of disability insurance that, and it's not Medicare or Medicaid. It's just funded by private insurance, I believe. But that's all I know.
And that is a start date somewhere in 2011, according to the sheet we have in front of us, but again, I'm not sure it's going to do everything you'd like it to do.
One thing that caught my attention is that residency slots might be capped. That would imply that a fairly large number of medical students and interns would not find a position as a practicing physician. By the same token, there will be a great shortage of physicians. Their education is not entirely wasted, but it will deprive us of their services. Now, how would you decide which medical students will get one of those slots as residents? Is it a form of triage whereby you would say we need general practitioners, we need neurosurgeons, we need obstetricians, and therefore we favor those? Or how would you make the decision? And also, I would like you to address the problem of fraud in the Medicare reimbursement system, which it is said siphons off billions of dollars off a system that is financially challenged. So I don't know which one of you two would address these two questions.
Right, that's a great question. And, you know, currently the residents, the medical students are matched, by some computer program, I think, for their preference and the hospital's preference. But I think there probably would need to be, kind of a triage system, as you suggested. I don't have the answer for that. I do think that that there will be more primary care slots available, and that those are going to be the number one. Those in general surgeons would be preferred.
My question to you is whether or not you have any concerns that perhaps the system of health care in this country will be unable to maintain equipment and innovative practices within the framework of what constitutes a viable lifetime for specific technical equipment for tests.
You want me to try? I'll try that one. But I want to go back. We didn't finish answering this, and I think the former physician was going to respond to that. Just on the medical education side, the only thing that I would add is that I think you're going to see a lot more physician extenders, nurse practitioners, and the like being used. I think you're going to see more foreign graduate medical students, here in the United States. I do think that the government always seems slow to respond and then perhaps over-responds, and that they will kind of get on board. But the problem is it takes the pipeline to get a neurosurgeon, as you mentioned, is so darn long. You have to go to college, you go to medical school, Then you become a surgeon, you become a neurosurgeon. You can get out. We have one physician from the Cleveland Clinic. He's an electrophysiologist, a certain part of cardiology. You know, he didn't get out of the program until like he was 44 years of age. So you could start tomorrow, and it takes an awful long time for that to happen. In regards to the waste, let me say, I don't know. You hear all these astronomical numbers, and it's also easy to say, sometimes use that as the sledgehammer to say, boy, that can change because there's so much waste, and, you know, if you did this, there'd be billions and billions of dollars left over. There are probably any system as large as Medicare or healthcare in general, there's going to be some real waste. Some people also call it fraud. Some probably is fraud. It's hard to determine, but I can tell you there is a certain amount of waste. And it may not be the type of waste that you automatically think about. And this is where hospitals and doctors can do a lot better, and where the health care reform bill tries to talk to and even tries to help. For instance, after a board meeting, I had, you know, two of our doctors talking, and they said, you know, Jim, there is some waste even here, because some doctor, a good primary care doctor, might order 6 tests when only 3 are really needed. But part of that is malpractice insurance. They feel, boy, if I don't order a CT scan, an MR, 6 tests instead of 3, you know, 1 out of 10,000, I'm going to be in trouble. And if everyone else is doing it, even though I do the right thing, then I'm not meeting the community standard of care. And then some of it is because someone comes in, you know, they might go to an urgent care center, they go to an emergency room, and they go to their private doctor. None of these individuals, these are different physical facilities, know what's done elsewhere, and they order tests that don't need to be ordered but were already done. And so in this bill, there is for it's either electronic medical records or electronic health care records, some sort of payment encouragement for physicians to get on board. But it's very expensive for them to get on, and supposedly they can get, if they have meaningful use by such and such date, they can receive up to $40,000 towards this. Well, most physicians, when they look at it and figure out what they have to do, one, it slows their productivity down. They probably can't meet meaningful use. It's spread out. So in other words, if you don't do so much by each year, you get less and less and less, and they can't run that fast, quite frankly. And then in the end, while they may do it, there's a penalty if you don't have it in 4 years. So there's different types of waste. Some of the things that I think that hospitals are doing, and this gets to your question on hospitals all across the country, as our physicians are trying very, very hard to have electronic medical records, or even more than that, quite frankly, so that they can talk to one another. So a test, if it's done at UVA and someone comes from Arthur Jefferson or vice versa, they can be just looked at and determine, oh, you know, doesn't need to be redone, we'll accept that. Oftentimes institutions haven't always accepted it because, as Carol mentioned before, the fee-for-service basis in which American medicine is premise on is the more you do, the more you get paid. And think how ironic this is. In a hospital, the more that is done in the hospital, quite frankly, the less reimbursement we get, or surplus. You know, we don't like to call it profit, surplus. Whereas the doctor, the more he or she orders, the better they do. And it's this vicious cycle that goes round and around and around. So that's a structural problem that really does need to be changed, but it's not going to be easy to change that. But I think everybody's aware of that, and we're trying to work on it. Some doctors, I do think there'll be more primary care doctors, and we certainly need that for a whole host of reasons, including keeping our health care costs down. But over the last several years, Carol probably knows this better than I, there's something called radio or something like this. It's radiologists, anesthesiologists, dermatologists, and ophthalmologists. And why do you think people are going into those specialties? Because they're called lifestyle specialties. Because nowadays you can stay at home and read a radiology, a film from your house. Anesthesiologists can be, you know, kind of set if they want. Dermatology, there's not too many emergency calls at 2 in the morning. And ophthalmologists, the same thing. So different incentives, whether it be lifestyle or payment, help determine what people go into. That's not entirely. Some people probably at the age of 2 know they're going to be a neurosurgeon, but there's going to be fewer and fewer of those if it takes all these years to get into it. And then there's poor reimbursement and the like. I didn't fully answer your question about all the equipment. I think that's going to be a big challenge. I mean, America has an amazing ability in its healthcare system to do so many things, but it is expensive, and all of us want it done right away. And I can tell you, I get calls all the time from good people in this community. Jim, do I really have to wait a week to get that MRI? You know, and this is an MRI that could be done a month from now. It's not emergent. So it's our own culture that forces us sometimes to determine so much what we ask for and what we want immediately.
Thank you. Is there any push to give bonuses or to help with medical school to send them to the rural areas? There was at one time, I believe.
Well, yes, they, you know, the, for instance, the residency training slots that are being redistributed throughout the country are going to primarily rural areas, medically underserved and health profession shortage areas. So from that standpoint, yes. You know, the bill includes incentives for medical students to go into primary care, and you know, they want to encourage the primary care doctors to, you know, go and practice in the rural areas. I mean, the reality of the situation, however, though, is that it's just not very practical to do that. You know, not... The numbers just aren't there to sustain their practice. Then when you combine that with, Jim was talking about the electronic medical record, which we didn't even really get into with healthcare reform, because it's actually not part of the healthcare reform. It is a part of it, but not technically in the bill. This was authorized by the stimulus bill, actually, where they are encouraging through incentive payments for providers and hospitals to use an electronic medical record. And, you know, the cost of that is just tremendous. And I don't know, you know, how many solo practitioners and smaller rural places are going to be able to handle that.
I'll see if I can say this coherently. When the Medicare prescription drug benefit was introduced during the Bush administration, there was a decision not to attempt to negotiate drug prices with the drug companies. And I am getting the feeling that with the cost of the drug, a prescription, brand name prescription drugs coming down at a particular point in the donut hole, that there will be some jawboning that will go on with the drug companies? Or is that an inference that I shouldn't be
making? To my knowledge, there's nothing in the bill that requires mandates such negotiations between the government and the pharmaceutical companies. So I think it's the same situation that was under Bush. It's under the new Obama Care Act.
That's my recollection. In fact, if you remember, in the early days to get the drug companies on, American Medical Association, American Hospital Association, each one of those came in with a certain amount of kind of give up. I know the Hospital Association said they would forego, I don't know, $150 billion over so many years. I think the drug companies did well. That was kind of that compromise. So that may happen, but I don't think it's firmly established in any part of the bill.
Thank you. You've been talking in very broad strokes, billions and millions of dollars, and I have a couple of examples and questions about cost in a very specific way. I received a bill not too long ago, and it cost $40 to take my pulse. And a number of years ago, I've noticed that hospitals have changed their equipment from reusable equipment that gets washed and sterilized and all that to everything being plastic, which gets thrown away after every single use. Now, to me, I don't understand why I'm being charged $40 to have something, a little machine, take my pulse. Plus, what is the benefit of, if we're talking about waste, what is the benefit versus, you know, with this plastic versus something that can be reused and sterilized and can by itself maybe create some jobs or replace the jobs of all the plastic that's being thrown away. So,
well, I think there's two questions, and unfortunately, I think one is certainly directed towards me, maybe both. I don't know where the setting you had, you know, but that will determine. If you go to your primary care physician, you will get the best cost-benefit of pulse, whatever. It's just going to be less expensive there. Every hospital has its own charge system. Part of this bill actually talks to, you know, transparencies and the like, but it's very difficult, believe it or not, for hospitals to say, well, I should know what a hip operation costs. Well, there's a range, because if a hip operation on a 25-year-old is going to be a lot different than an 85-year-old, because one is going to take a lot more service than the other, a lot more care than the other. So as far as the disposables versus the non-disposables, you know, I've been in business in one form or fashion, or a hospital for, you know, the last 40 years, and I can tell you, whether it be on syringes or in the cafeteria to use, you know, plastic forks or, you know, metal forks, has been this great debate. And, you know, someone will come in and say it's just less expensive, you know, to use one and get rid of it versus cleaning it, sending it back, and, you know, working it through. And they'll say, well, no, it's better to do what you suggested as well. And you can make a strong argument either way. I think also the other argument that has become much stronger in hospitals is, quite frankly, the this area of sterilization, and be sure you don't get MRSA, you know, but people bringing in MRSA, then there's something called C. diff. So part of it just has to do with that whole particular process. But I think hospitals, by and large, are just trying to look at what's least expensive for them. Now, you certainly could argue on an environmental standpoint, well, that's not very good either. But it usually comes down to, because hospitals are under a lot of pressure to keep their costs down. And I suspect that was the deciding factor on that. You know, some, it depends again what it is, but, you know, some are just more disposable, as opposed to dropping them off, using them, collecting them, taking them back to be sterilized, categorized, and then brought back again. It's really kind of that labor cost.
Have any of you considered or come across information regarding the amount of cost in this healthcare reform, which is going to be incurred by the number of increased personnel at the governmental level for enforcement and regulation?
I'm not aware of any information on that. I've not seen it.
I'm not sure that they included that cost in the bill, but there will be a cost to that.
There'll be a large cost. Now, in one place, they're hiring 1,600 more individuals. I think IRS just to follow it. So there's a price there too. Yeah.
I have a couple of questions. One is, it says that immediately children with pre-existing conditions cannot be rejected, but for adults, it's not until 3 to 4 more years, 2014, so that for-profit insurance companies can turn down people for health care. Is that correct?
That's correct, and that's why they established these high-risk pools to cover people with pre-existing conditions. So that there is, the Act is covering that from 2010 to 2014 with the high-risk pools.
But there are still people who are not covered, correct? I mean, even in the long term. So, I mean, up until now, 20,000 people in the prime of life die for...
how many people?
It's estimated about 20,000 people in the recent past have died for lack of health care, and they're in the prime of life. I also wanted to ask you, you're on Optima. Is that a health care company?
It's a health care plan, yes. It's a not-for-profit health care plan that the Sentara health care system... which is a not-for-profit hospital system, you know, has and runs and operates as well.
In the subsidies for low-income people to get health insurance,
will that impact the participation of people who are in low income in rural areas, and are there plans to disseminate that information and encourage them to take advantage of those insurance possibilities, which will help boost the participation in the healthcare system in the rural areas and support a physician who is looking to practice there?
You know, they are, in effect, a lot of those individuals will be covered under Medicaid. And so from a coverage standpoint, there are coverage approaches, and we talked about tax credits for those who don't meet the Medicaid qualification of how they can get health insurance, and the government will help in that way through tax credits or through Medicaid eligibility. So I think it does address that as far as the question of care delivery and small communities. I turn to Jim on that, or Carol, I don't know.
No, not really. I just would echo what Saunders said, and I think, you know, the government does have this website out there, and they've produced pamphlets. You know, I don't know how they intend to, you know, get the word out, but you know, certainly if the person, you know, goes to the hospital. You know, the hospital has in place, you know, that they can get them enrolled in Medicaid or, you know, educate them about their options. So that may be another way.
For me, the answer to your question is we don't know. As you saw what Saunders put up there, that there's even a penalty, I forget what year, if, you know, you don't go out and, you know, join one of these healthcare programs. But some people have said, you know, if you're young and 24 and invincible, you just take the penalty, you know. You don't think you need health care insurance. So I don't know. That remains to be seen. Some people don't think it's enough of a penalty. And you saw from Sana's presentation that the penalty goes up over various years. But, again, I don't think we know.
When we're speaking about waste, I wonder whether there will be a cap on the number of medical facilities that try to keep up with each other in ordering the very latest equipment, which is obviously very expensive, when maybe it can be obtained in another facility which is close by. And I don't understand, is the bill mandating the cap on the residency slots? So why is this being raised?
Carol, you want to take the second question first, and I'll take
The health care reform law does not cap the residency slots. I brought it up just to point out the fact that the residency slots have been capped by, you know, another law, but it helps to. It just exacerbates the physician shortage, the workforce shortage that will that looms in the future. So, well, it's the program is funded by Medicare, so it's the MedPAC group.
They'll only pay for so many slots, and they won't pay for more. So the part about, you know, if you will hospital facilities, you know, be capped or reduced and maybe prevent some of the waste, not directly, but very, very much indirectly. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt. I mean, someone's slides showed providers, not only doctors, but a number of hospitals going out of business because you can't reduce that kind of payment. And, you know, maybe they should. Maybe they should join one another. You can argue that, you know, you don't need the Martha Jefferson Hospital because the University of Virginia Medical Center does everything and more than the Martha Jefferson Hospital does. And others would argue that, you know, competition is good and choice is good as well. And they do have different missions. I think there's arguments on both sides. I can tell you that You heard Rockingham Memorial Community Hospital, large hospital in Harrisonburg. A sole provider just decided to join the Sentara healthcare system. I can tell you that Sibley Hospital in Georgetown, a very nice neighborhood, a very nice hospital, has joined the Johns Hopkins health system. Curiously enough, Suburban Hospital in Maryland also joined the Johns Hopkins system. But the most interesting one is that the Children's Hospital of Florida joined the Johns Hopkins system. So I got something in the mail 3 or 4 weeks ago from the Cleveland Clinic, a fine, fine institution, but it was a letter from their executive director, CEO, Dr. Del Cosgrove, very famous cardiovascular surgeon in America, and it had a picture of a jet on it. And the letter went on to say that we do over 4,000 transports from all over parts of America to the Cleveland Clinic every single year. And that, so this wasn't a helicopter. This was a jet that had Cleveland Clinic across it. Having said that, I went to the Cleveland Clinic to have a mitral valve repaired about 9 years ago. And in that process, I actually looked at 6 different hospitals to see which was the kind of most expensive. Now, maybe I would have gone to the most expensive if I felt it was still the best thing to do. Turned out in this particular case, the Cleveland Clinic was the second least expensive. There's one less expensive in California. And I also saw the best. So competition, the reduction in reimbursement is going to see a lot of these facilities, these pieces of equipment and the like, capped, if you will, or quite frankly reduced. In some places that'll probably be good. In other places it won't be, because it might be the only small facility in that area that is needed. The government does have a program called Critical Access Hospitals, where they pay higher Medicare payments to keep those hospitals going. But even with that higher payment, we have a deficit. They're going to get paid less over time. The crush will be on. So we may get there, but probably not in a very nice, neat, orderly way.
First, I want to congratulate each of you for having given a great presentation and sort of good complimentary efforts on the part of each of you. And one of the things I had questions on, though, we're talking about costs. And Carol, in your presentation, you mentioned something about the Washington Examiner. And the Washington Examiner had something about the costs for Medicare are going to change because they're going to be put back of Medicaid in time. Now, that implies to me that there's going to be less care for Medicare for older people than we may have anticipated. So that's question number one. The other question is on the question of liability and torts. Is anything addressed in this that will help you so far as liability costs are concerned?
Concerning the second question first, the health care reform bill does not really have any tort reform aspect to it. Now, concerning the costs, the Washington Examiner opinion that I got that information from was referring to the cuts to Medicare providers that have been put off each year that Jim talked about. It's the sustainable growth rate, and I can't explain how we got in this situation, but every year Congress delays implementing the cuts. If they did implement the cuts, then this year alone, Medicare providers would have, their pay would have been cut 21%. So they're pointing out that if those cuts ever do go into effect, that Medicare payments will likely fall below Medicaid payments as they are right now. So.
If I could add just one thing to that is that if you the first class, if you will, of the baby boomers was supposedly born in 1946. So they are very soon to enter the Medicare program. All right? And when they enter the Medicare program, that cohort is so large and so great, and because modern medicine has been able to do so many things, people can live, you know, so much longer. Cataracts are taken care of. We have people coming into the hospital all the time now getting knees and hips at 84 and 85. When the Medicare program was envisioned back in 65, 66, life expectancy wasn't even close to what it is, and what medicine can do was unfathomable to that day. And so the expense is going to get so great for this cohort that's living longer, and more things can be done. I give you a little anecdote. I was at somebody's 50th birthday party. A woman comes up to me. She said, "Jim, I understand you went to the Cleveland Clinic, had your mitral valve replaced." And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Well, what do you think about it?" And so on and so forth. And I said, "Well, are you going to have your mitral valve or one of your valves repaired or fixed?" "Oh, no, no. I'm talking for my father. My father is 93 years old. And he has done some research, and he knew that the mortality was a little bit higher, but it was still, you know, successful 91% of the time." And she says, "He said, Medicare pays, you know, most of it. I don't have to worry about it." And so, you know, good for medicine, you know, good for him. We had a consultant once said, you know, "It depends who pays, you know. When you come in and you tell my father he needs, you know, his mitral valve repaired and he's 93, I would say, And I'm paying, or he's paying, my gosh, this man has lived a good, long life. You know, he's been a good father, a good husband. And let's not, you know, let him go in peace. You know, let's not cut open his chest, stop his heart, sew on his heart, put a lot of tubes in him, so on and so forth." Now, if you say Medicare or someone else is paying for it, "My father's been a citizen, a taxpayer, and you know what? He deserves the very best care, no matter what it costs, no matter what his age." That's kind of a situation we're talking about. You know, there's those trade-offs.
Do you know if there's anything in this health bill that would consider outsourcing medical care to foreign countries where there's a lot cheaper, no medical malpractice lawsuits, and a lot of people are now doing it to cut their medical expenses?
I don't think there's anything in the bill at all. There are certainly things, and employers will say, you know, we'll pay 100% if you will go, you know, somewhere else. You know, when HMOs were really big and managed care was even larger than it is, you know, today, like I said, when I looked around at different costs for this mitral valve repair, you could actually go to, you know, California and have it done for the least expensive. And I know that some companies said, you know what, there was a hospital system. It was either Scripps or Sharp down in San Diego. Very good outcomes. This would be for bypass surgery. And you could go there. They'd let you, they'd put up your spouse and stuff. And, you know, you'd go there and go to the San Diego Zoo and still save the employer $12,000 to $14,000. You know what? I think that's going to be up to individuals. Maybe if you had a voucher system, you know, and the government said, and some people think it's going to end up where Medicare gives everybody, you know, a set amount of money, and you spend it. It's your dollars, you know, and then you might say, "Hey, I will go to Costa Rica." Most people, quite frankly, you want to stay close to home, you know. They do. Even when I was in Cleveland Clinic, I think it was the best place for me to go. I remember thinking, it'd be nice to be in Charlottesville recovering, you know, and what happens if something happens. But I guess if the price point gets bad enough, people will go elsewhere because it is a lot less expensive elsewhere. And in some of those places, they actually have fine hospital surgical services, without a doubt.
Two issues that I intentionally didn't include in my presentation that I'd like to comment briefly on. One is state Medicaid, which in effect is a federal state-funded program. And so the state has got to come up with its share. And as a result of the act, one of the things that has an impact is this high-risk pool. Each state has the option of creating that high-risk pool 2010 to 2014 or not. If it does not, then the feds will step in and create a high-risk pool for Virginia. Many states are drawing back from that because the feds are only going to put $5 billion up in funding, and this is for covering pre-existing conditions and retirees, early retirees. And so that's an issue. We noted that 2014 to 2016, the number of eligible people who are not eligible under Medicaid now would be covered 100% by the federal government, but it's only to 2014 to 2016. After that, then there's state participation, and we're talking about 32 million more eligible. So the impact potentially on the cost of the Medicaid program for Virginia and other states is enormous. And that, of course, is not getting a lot of discussion now, but by 2014, it's certainly going to get draw a lot of fire. The other thing that Jim pointed to, which I didn't touch, is employers. That employers are incentivized under this plan to sort of to walk away from their group insurance plans. It's less expensive to pay a fine of $2,000 per employee than to pay $8,000 per employee for health coverage. This means that in 2014, that many employed individuals are going to find they have no group coverage. They're going to have to go to these insurance exchanges, information exchanges, to acquire insurance for them and their families. And for most, I would think it would be at individual rates. Individual rates are much more expensive than group insurance. And so this is another, a very explosive issue that's there, but it doesn't blossom until 2014, as we get closer.
We have time for one more quick question.
I think one of the reasons this whole subject has such big implications is everybody's been talking about the expense side, but nobody's been talking about the income side. At this particular time in our political history, practically everyone running for any kind of public office hits the subject of taxation. As a matter of fact, overall our tax rates are much lower than they've been historical. Even at a time when we've been waging wars, our higher tax rates have been reduced, which benefited the wealthier and higher income members of our society. I think the issue that has to be addressed before the state goes bankrupt and has to eliminate additional assistance to medical expenses, we have to address the issues of taxation, and nobody's willing to do that.
Okay, well, that we will end it at that, and I want to thank the panel for a very, very interesting discussion. Thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I am Dan Gould.